All right, we have no more than about 10 minutes left here in Open Lines. And after that, we'll be talking with Robert Tyler, legal counsel for the California Regional Service Center of the Alliance Defense Fund. They've been in the news, of course. We'll get an update on gay marriage in San Francisco as the news continues to break there. Until then, Open Lines for your questions and your comments. We're talking about a specific question I want your answer to. If your congregation decided to drop its label, be it a denominational label like Lutheran, Presbyterian, Baptist, Methodist, or if it decided to simply, if you're a non-denominational congregation, to drop the title Christian from its name, would you object to that? After all, the logic being used by Max Lucado, who's dropped the denominational label from his San Antonio church, is that label was a bit of an obstacle to people who would normally attend a church, but when they see the term Church of Christ, when they see that term, they might turn away. And his church has gone from 3,300 to 4,500 since they dropped the Churches of Christ label. Would you object? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And as usual, Open Lines is anything you want to talk about. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. After our short conversation with Robert Tyler, we'll spend an hour talking with Dr. John Seleska of the Concordia Bible Institute, a review of Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. We're talking about $300 million domestically, and it's ready to open internationally, expected to at least double that. And then we are not even counting DVD, VHS, and merchandising from that film. So it's obviously been a splash. Eric Rotman joins us for the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. to talk about Simon Peter and The Last Supper. It's Open Lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. This is a broader topic, isn't it? The whole issue of what you call yourself. Before the break, I had asked the question, if your son on his 18th birthday decided he wanted to change his last name, if he wanted to change his last name, because the name had been an albatross to him in high school, and now he'd like to advance his career, his love life, his other ambitions, and he doesn't want the albatross of your name hanging around his neck, he'll change it from Smith to Jones. How would you take that? It's not that he has anything against you or your grandfather, your great-grandpappy, all had those names. But, you know, for him, he's got to be able to redefine himself. And that's an obstacle in his life. What would you make of it? Jeff is calling from his car. Jeff, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. I think that I'm proud of our name. So, and our name has the good stuff, and I want people to know where the good stuff is at, so I want them to know the name of our church.
Okay, how would you react if your pastor said, look, that's fine for you, Jeff, because you understand all the good stuff that's wrapped up in this label, but the average person on the street, for them, it's simply either confusing or it's a barrier. We need to drop the name. How would you react?
I would say what we need to do is go tell the people where the good stuff's at, not change the name, change the attitude about get them to the good stuff.
Jeff, thank you very much. You know, Jeff there, I think Jeff speaks in terms of the name Lutheran. Now, what does the name Lutheran say to the uninitiated? It doesn't say a lot. The most they could, if they even are a casual student of history, the most they could conclude from it is these people are somehow followers of Luther. Followers of Luther's teaching or theology, which isn't altogether inaccurate, although that's not as accurate as it should be. And someone would say, well, there's nothing wrong with Lutheran theology, but the name is an obstacle. Like the son who says, Dad, look, there's nothing wrong with Smith. I know that Smith has been a great name for you and your grandfather and your great-grandfather. I know it's always held the family in good stead, but for me, it's an obstacle, don't you see, Dad? I know it's a good name, and it's got all sorts of good stuff associated with it, but I'm changing my name, or I'm dropping it altogether. Let's talk with Larry calling from his car. Larry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you. I think the name is important, and I think I would be distressed if it was changed or dropped. Maybe I'm oversimplifying, but it's kind of like going to the store for milk and you're looking for whole milk, and then you get it and you find out it's 2%. You know, it's not what you wanted, and it's not what you expected, even though it's still milk. And I am Lutheran, and I know from the other end, what it was like. We were living in a small town. There was a Lutheran church in the town, and we are Lutheran, but we didn't know what synod it was. And so we went to a church service there, and we found out about three-quarters of the way through the sermon that it wasn't where we wanted to be, you know, going back to the whole milk 2% thing.
Larry, thank you very much. I mean, worse yet, if you went in to buy milk and you pulled the carton off the... and it just said liquid. Liquid. Well, what kind of liquid is it? We don't know. You got to open it and find out. You walk up to a church, it says church. Or just family fellowship or something. What do they teach? We don't know. You got to go in and find out. Okay, I go in. How long does it take me to find out? After all the handshaking, the clapping, the loud music, they'll do a seminar for 3 weeks on family values. When am I going to find out what they actually teach? Maybe that's all they teach. Who knows? How long do I have to continue to before I figure out what this liquid is? Could be orange juice. Could be pineapple juice. Might be beer. We don't know. It might be hard liquor. Would you pour a glass for your five-year-old child? To drink up, son. What is it, Dad? We don't know. Taste it and tell us. Could be poison. Could be fertilizer that you pour on your yard, son. Your mom got a little sick from the last one, so we're asking you to be the guinea pig this time. It says liquid, so we know that it's at least in liquid form, right? Could be milk, could be fertilizer. I don't know, it might be raw sewage. You never know. Chet's calling from his car.
Hello, Pastor Ty.
Hi, Chet.
I don't know, you kind of swayed me a little bit. I was contemplating this issue by rearranging the name of my Baptist church, which is Mount Zion Missionary Baptist. And if they dropped the Baptist out of it, it would be Mount Zion Missionary Church. But I think the most essential thing is Max Licato still preaching the true gospel message. You had a call of Jeff a little while ago. He talked about, you know, your church having the good stuff. To me, the good stuff is the gospel of Jesus Christ, regardless to what denomination.
Amen.
But you swayed me a bit, you know, in the comments you said about, you know, not being able to specifically define your doctrine, you know, by not having a specific doctrine name attached to a church. I can see the importance of that. But when you brought this topic up earlier, the first question that came to my mind is he still adhering to the truth of the gospel? Because as you've talked to me before, you know, I lean a little bit more towards loyalty to Christ the Savior, more so than my particular denominational background anyway. But, you know, that's just my perspective.
Chet, thank you. Here's part of the danger. The part of the danger is that not that when you go to the store to buy milk and it just says liquid on the carton that you're going to get something poisonous. That's dangerous. It could be poison. It could also just be nothing. It could be empty. It could be full of water. But I need some sustenance. Milk has nutrition. Well, you know, the nutrition was offending people. People don't like that milky flavor, so we decided to fill all our cartons with water. Water is unoffensive. Everyone likes water. Not everyone likes milk. So now instead of selling milk, we just put these cartons on the shelf, says liquid, and they have water in them. Doesn't help you. Doesn't hurt you. You don't really get anything out of it. It has no flavor, but it doesn't offend anybody. Unoffensive liquid. That's what I'll sell. Unoffensive liquid. Probably make $1 million. Lael is calling from Webster Groves. Hi, Lael.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well.
You know what? It sounds like it's a bait and switch to me, and we've got to be real careful with that because, after all, Christ is the rock. And if you want to take his name out of who we are to bait and switch, I mean, how ethical is that really? And I think there's a delusion there that of the gospel that can mislead people.
Lael, thank you. That might also be at work here, too. A little bit of the bait and switch, which is, look, I know that it's somehow been baptized and sanctified to be the most brilliant marketing idea that the church has ever known, the bait and switch. But up until the point when the church decided it was ethical, it was generally considered unethical, even by people who used it all the time. Bait and switch. Have you ever been called down for one of those things? We have a free weekend at our condos down here. Free. You don't have to pay a thing. We'll pay your meals and everything. Come on down. Any strings attached? Yeah, you will have to sit through a 3-hour seminar on buying property down here. Oh. Bait and switch. Ann's calling from Crestwood. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good afternoon, Todd. I wanted to say that I don't think people care about theology a whole much. I think they go to church for many different reasons. Some of it is because their friends are there, because of the music. They want to be entertained. But how many of them truly want to learn what is the truth, what is the gospel, and will adhere to that kind of a regimen, I guess? There is a church in Kirkwood that used to be a Latter-day Saints, and it's called something different now with the Christian Family Church or something different. And it bothered me when I saw that because I thought people would be deceived in going there, and some would get hooked into it, and that was disturbing to me.
Ann, thank you very much. Now, there's an actual example of what I was talking about before. We would say, look, if they did that, if the Mormons changed their name to Family Community Fellowship, and you had no indication of what it was, someone going in there might, before they know it, be a Mormon. And they think they're going to a Christian church. Or at least they thought up until the point where they accepted Joseph Smith into their heart that they were going to a Christian church. You'd say, that's not truthful. That's deceptive. If your church believes and teaches something, don't you think you owe it to the culture, to the public, to say what it is you believe and you teach, not either hiding it by baiting and switching or hiding it by refusing to accept a label that otherwise would accurately describe what it is you teach and believe? This is the thought I had on this. I've had it before, but it's coming back. It has to do with shame. I'm not going to accuse Max Lucado of being ashamed of Churches of Christ. I think he's well-intentioned. But he has made the church-going public, he's made their task of finding out what it is he teaches and preaches just one step harder by refusing to be known as a Churches of Christ. Now, I'll commend him for his honesty. If he's going to deviate from the teachings of the Churches of Christ in baptism and the other teachings that he's decided to throw aside, maybe it's more honest of him to drop the name. And I would say the same thing to churches that are Presbyterian, Lutheran, Baptist, Methodist. If you're going to chuck what it means to be Presbyterian, Lutheran, Baptist, or Methodist, then be honest. I don't want you keeping the name on your signboard. Take it down. Truth in Advertising. I really don't care what you call yourself, but don't confuse people by saying you're one thing and teaching another thing. Any more than we would want the Mormons to say they're Christians and teach Mormon doctrine. The same kind of honesty. But it has to do with shame. For the churches that say they still do teach what Presbyterians, Lutherans, Methodists, Baptists teach, and yet don't want the name, I would ask, what are you ashamed of? In the same way you would ask your son when he decides on his 18th birthday to drop your surname. You'd say, son, what are you ashamed of? What are you ashamed of? And if he says, Dad, I'm not ashamed of anything. I'm not ashamed of the name, then why don't you keep it? I still believe everything the name stands for. Why don't you keep it, son? What are you ashamed of? It's a good question. It's a question that deserves an answer. In fact, it wasn't too long ago in my own church body that you heard a lot of Lutherans talking about being ashamed of being Lutheran. And I thought to myself, what are you ashamed of? Are you ashamed of the teaching of grace alone? Of faith alone, of Christ alone, of Scripture alone? Which of those four are you ashamed of? You ashamed of our teaching on baptism or the Lord's Supper or absolution, on the teaching of law and gospel? What are you ashamed of? A church that says, look, we are Christian, but we don't want to be called Christian. We are Presbyterian, but we don't want to be called Presbyterian. We are Lutheran, but we don't want to be called Lutheran. A good question to ask is, what are you ashamed of? What about being a Christian or a Presbyterian or a Lutheran are you ashamed of? Up until the break, we're going to be talking here with Robert Tyler. He's legal counsel for the California Regional Service Center for the Alliance Defense Fund. He is also among those his organization has filed a suit against the city of San Francisco. We're going to get an update on gay marriage in San Francisco. Robert, welcome to Issues, Etc. We'll get Robert here in just a second. Robert, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. Give us an update on the latest in San Francisco and the gay marriage situation, if you would.
Sure. As you may have heard in the news, we had filed a petition at the California Supreme Court a few weeks ago, and just last Thursday, the California Supreme Court issued an immediate stay, ordering that the city and county of San Francisco cease issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. From here, where we go is the court ordered a further hearing, which will take place in late May or sometime in June. And basically what the court did is say that, you know, the city was violating the law. And essentially what they're doing is giving the city an opportunity to come to, well, try to change the court's mind if that's possible, and really don't think it is.
Is there any legal basis for what the mayor of San Francisco and those under his employment have been doing for the last month or so in San Francisco?
No, there's none whatsoever. First of all, California law specifically prohibits a mayor from just determining on his own what the law should or should not be. It is absolutely, you know, just out of hand for a mayor of any city in any state to determine what the law is. I mean, it's just not how democracy works. We have, in America, a system of procedure through the courts, through the legislature, and you can't have rogue mayors anywhere in the nation deciding for themselves what the law should or should not be. That's what we call municipal anarchy.
Now, the mayor in San Francisco has asserted from the very beginning that the Defense of Marriage Act in California is unconstitutional, and that he finds nothing in the state constitution that would prohibit him from issuing marriage licenses. Is that the real issue here, the constitutionality of the DOMA statute?
Well, initially, the real issue here is whether or not the mayor has any authority to decide for himself. And the answer is no. And that's what the Supreme Court has essentially said by the ruling just last week. Now what has happened is the city and county of San Francisco, along with the ACLU, they filed suit challenging the constitutionality of California's marriage laws that say marriage can only be between a man and a woman. So now they have, you know, frankly, they've finally gone about it the right way. If you want to change law, you can go to your legislature to try to get them to change it, or if you think the law is unconstitutional, you can file a lawsuit. And that is what the city and county of San Francisco have done now. You know, they couldn't get what they, you know, they couldn't get it accomplished by just municipal anarchy, because finally the Supreme Court put the stop to that. But now they're seeking to challenge it in the courts.
Why, in your opinion, did they not do that to begin with?
You know, I think that they knew that there would be no repercussions from the Attorney General, from our governor. I think that they just looked at this and figured, hey, we can get away with this, and we can make a big make a big splash in the media, and as they have said numerous times in court, have been in court with them, and they basically have said, we want to put a face to these folks who are not able to get married. And so they're trying to use the media and trying to desensitize Americans to seeing homosexuals kiss on TV, frankly.
What becomes of the marriage licenses that have already been issued from the courthouse in San Francisco? We're now talking perhaps even upward of 4,000.
Well, at this point in time, there has been no ruling with regard to the validity of those marriage licenses. However, you know, the Supreme Court said that what the mayor was doing was in violation of the law. The Supreme Court specifically told the mayor and the county clerk, you must comply with California law that prohibits same-sex marriage licenses. So, you know, on one hand, the Supreme Court is saying what was done is unlawful. And so then the next thing that we have here is coming in late May or June, then the court is going to issue its final ruling. And I believe at that point in time, it'll be very clear that those marriage licenses will be deemed unlawful and invalid.
So they're simply voided by the court's decision, whatever piece of paper a gay couple may have procured in San Francisco in the last month that says marriage license would now be essentially not worth the paper it's printed on?
I believe that's exactly what's going to happen, that the Supreme Court will issue a ruling. Those marriage licenses will not be worth the paper they're written on.
What about those who have taken those marriage licenses to states far-flung and afar in the contiguous 48 states and tried to use them, or will in the future try to use them, to get a civil union or a marriage in those states?
Well, here again, if the marriage license is not valid in California, it's not valid anywhere else. And, in fact, the form that is given to these folks who sought to obtain a marriage license, the form specifically tells those people that those marriage licenses are invalid. It says that their validity is questionable in other jurisdictions. And so, I would encourage anybody who, any governmental agency or any employer, anyone who comes across one of these marriage licenses and the person is asserting the authenticity and validity of those marriage licenses, I would encourage those people to reject them as being invalid and seek their lawyer to talk about that and make sure they're doing the right thing.
Why do you think the state governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the Attorney General of California dragged their feet for the last several weeks on this issue?
I think it's all about politics, first of all. I think that I think Governor Schwarzenegger was afraid to offend the liberal constituency in California, number one. I think that, I know that the Attorney General has stated that he does not agree with California's marriage laws. He comes from the very liberal persuasion, and he definitely does not stand arm in arm with us in the defense of California marriage laws. In fact, what he did is he came forward and made an appearance as though he was defending our laws, but in fact he submitted his petition to the California Supreme Court and requested that the court address the constitutionality of our marriage laws, but never once did he actually defend the constitutionality of our marriage laws. And so that's why we at the Alliance Defense Fund have stepped up to make sure that there is a proper defense asserted in the courts.
Robert, we have but 1 minute before we have to go to this break, no more than 1 minute. How do you expect the court to decide, and will there be any repercussions for Gavin Newsom?
I firmly believe the Supreme Court is going to rule in our favor in late May and August, whenever the hearing is set. With regard to Gavin Newsom, I think there are certainly things that could have been done to him by our Attorney General, just like that which occurred in New York. The city attorney should have done so, but they are all together on this one, and I believe that they all planned and participated in that.
Robert Tyler, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Tyler is legal counsel for the California Regional Service Center for the Alliance Defense Fund. The ADF filed suit against the city of California. We're getting our update on gay marriage there in San Francisco. If you want to visit their website, it's Alliance Defense Fund, all one word, alliancedefensefund.org. When we come back, we begin an hour-long conversation with Dr. John Seleska, his review of Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
St. Peter writes, Christ died for sins, once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. This is the message of Scripture. This is the heart of the Christian faith. This is the truth that Christians, young and old, live by. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for March is called Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. This children's book tells the story of God's grace through Jesus Christ to St. Peter. You can order Follow Me by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on the Issues Etc. book of the month for March, Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net, 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The Food and Drug Administration is considering warning labels on all condom packages. The message? Condoms don't protect you from all STDs. But one very influential doctor says the law is already on the books and simply needs to be enforced. Keith Peters has the story from Washington.
According to Dr. Daniel Schultz, director of the FDA's Office of Device Evaluation, they have developed a plan to provide condom users with a consistent labeling message and the protection they should expect from condom use. But Dr. and former Congressman Tom Coburn says the plan was developed several years ago.
There was a public law passed, actually I authored it right before I left Congress, which said that the FDA had to accurately label condoms as to their efficacy and what they do and what they don't do. And the FDA has been dragging its feet for 3.5 years not doing that.
The facts about condoms are these.
Condoms offer limited protection for most STDs, fairly good protection for HIV, and no protection for human papillomavirus, which causes all the cervical cancer in the country.
Brad Mattis of Life Issues Institute says Congress and many health agencies have put their head in the sand for too long about condoms, and they're hoping the problem goes away.
That is why we have cases of sexually transmitted diseases going through the roof at almost an epidemic level, but nobody's talking about it. They're just simply saying the condoms will take care of things, and the condoms are not.
Dr. Coburn says giving people the right information is not only the legal thing to do, it's also the only humane thing to do. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
Dr. Coburn warns that the FDA could face a lawsuit from people that have contracted cervical cancer because the condoms weren't labeled. Package labels now say that condoms, if properly used, reduce the risk of AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases. HPV is not addressed. More than 2 million American women are infected with HPV every year. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton for Diane Summers, inviting you to participate in our Living Jubilee. Living Jubilee comes your way Monday through Friday on AM 850 KFUO between 11 and noon. And this is your program. We try to book guests that will be stimulating and interesting and benefit you, the listener. That's Living Jubilee, Monday through Friday between 11 and noon, and only here on AM 850 KFUO.
Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for March, Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Eric Rotman. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org and click the What's New section or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The book is Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net.
Welcome back. For the next hour, we'll be getting a review of Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. 11% of all Americans have seen the film, and I think another 30% say that they're going to see the film. Much of the box office of the film in the opening week had to do with, well, what you'd expect, church groups that are buying blocks of tickets, but the box office did not die down after that. It's well on its way to being very lucrative, but in addition to that, for many, the only exposure that they have the only exposure they have in a complete way to the Passion account, rather than bits and pieces they may have picked up as children in Sunday school. So how accurate was Mel Gibson's film if measured against the gospel accounts? And what about the things that were added in that seemed a bit odd to all but perhaps devout Roman Catholic viewers of the film who recognize things like Stations of the Cross and various mystical traditions? Can we add those things without taking away from the account? We're going to talk about that with Dr. John Seleska during the next hour of Issues Etc. If you have a question or a comment on the film, feel free to give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. John Seleska is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's a former professor at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He serves currently as the director of the Concordia Bible Institute based in Mequon, Wisconsin. Dr. Seleska, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Very nice to be here.
We were very recently broadcasting in Mequon, and you were someplace else, and we missed you, and I was sorry not to be able to see you face to face.
Well, one time sometime in the future we'll be able to do that. I'm sorry that that happened, but we were out of town for a week.
Well, actually, I did get to look upon your visage once from a distance. We were actually speaking together up in Casper, Wyoming, recently. You were in one room. I was in the other room. You had your crowd. I had my crowd. And I did stand at the back of the room for a while and listen to a very moving presentation you were making for a group there. So I've seen you, although you haven't seen
me. I guess I haven't.
Dr. Seleska, your general overall review of the film, The Passion of the Christ?
Well, to begin with, I guess I would use the word powerful to describe it. And then words like brutal and heart-wrenching. It was very intense and to some degree frightening, too, when you consider the kind of punishment meted out by human beings, that they would be able not only to inflict this kind of carnage on Christ, but that also they would take some joy in doing so. It seems incredible, does it not, that human beings would be gleeful, as the Roman soldiers seemed to be, as they carried out this punishment on our Lord, that we would do this kind of thing to Christ, the very God of heaven and earth and the creator of the universe, and that he would take it. There were times, I guess, in the movie when they were beating him, when your heart would cry out, why doesn't someone intervene? That word, by the way, I guess brings to memory the hymn, the Lenten hymn, stricken, smitten, and afflicted, none would intervene to save. And you wanted him somehow to do something, to strike back. How could anyone be so powerful? And I think that really is the strength of what happened there, as you saw the beating, that he could be so strong as not to retaliate. Luther makes this statement, anyone can deliver a blow, but real strength lies in being able to endure a blow without the need to retaliate. And that's what we saw in Christ there.
Let's talk about the accuracy of the film measured against the four Gospels. It does say at the very beginning that it is based upon the four Gospels. How accurate is it? And let's talk specifically about those points of accuracy, beginning with the first scene, the Gethsemane trial of our Lord. How would you evaluate that opening scene against the Gospels?
Well, it wasn't, of course, entirely biblical. For instance, you have those temptations which occurred there in the garden. At the same time, it seemed to me at least to depict in a general way what happened. I am prone, I guess, in this instance to give Mel Gibson some artistic license to try to portray it as best he could so that it would be a moving presentation. But at the same time, there were some things which were obviously not accurate scripturally. There were the times when Christ was was referred to, or I should say with the mother, with Mary, who, first of all, Peter twice told her not to touch him. I think there were two times in which he told her not to touch him, as if there were some sort of holiness about her that he didn't deserve to take part in. I think that was true of both Peter and John. There were other instances in which you could see the Roman Catholic influence. Jesus confronting Judas after the arrest, you remember that one. I think Pontius Pilate's wife brought some cloths to Mary, and there was that incident of the crow poking out the eyes of that impenitent thief. I assume that he was bringing a kind of judgment for his unbelief. And then there was at the end, when the spear was poked into Christ's side, that there was that spurting stream of water, a kind of misting of blood pouring from Jesus' side. So there were a number of things which I take it were from Roman Catholic tradition. I think someone mentioned that this Catherine Emmerich book, she's a mystic nun, that some of the things which he took from that text found their way into the movie. But the accuracy, I think, could be seen in the portrayal, I think, really, of the beating itself. Now, a lot of people thought that that was carried to extreme. But at the same time, if you'll think of what he is undergoing here as fulfilling all the sacrificial events in the Old Testament, that he is really the embodiment of that, foreshadowed by all the sacrifices, I think beginning with Genesis and finding their way through, threading through all of the Old Testament, that beating, as terrible as it was, could finally, I think, in no way picture the great sacrifices that you would find from the Old Testament all the way into the New. So I think that was, although a terrible beating, yet at the same time indicative of sacrifices and of how the animals were treated in the Old Testament, and in a certain sense he becomes so disfigured. There's a statement in, I think, Isaiah 60 or 52, just before Isaiah 53, and he hath no form nor comeliness, but his visage was so marred, I believe that's the way the King James puts it, that he was unrecognizable as a person. And I think the film carried that out quite well, although there are people who do speak up and out against that kind of thing. But I don't know that it was really too extreme.
Dr. Seleska, you mentioned Isaiah 53, the Suffering Servant song, and it's been my contention immediately after I saw the film the first time that the film is based upon Isaiah 53 as much as it is based upon the Gospels account, the narratives there, or even the mystical visions of a nun or the Stations of the Cross. Isaiah 53 seems to be the subtext of the entire film. So where license is taken and brutality and things like that, It seems to be hearkening to Isaiah 53's account of Christ's suffering rather than the kind of sparse details that we get of the suffering from the gospel accounts. What do you think? I think we just lost our guest, Dr. Seleska. We'll be reconnecting with him in just a moment. Bad phone line. We're getting a review of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. Dr. Seleska, are you there? We're getting a review of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. Dr. Seleska is a former professor at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's currently the director of the Concordia Bible Institute based in Mequon, Wisconsin. If you have a question or comment about the film, we have an hour-long conversation with Dr. Seleska ahead reviewing this film. Any question or comment you might have, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Just a reminder that in the last half hour of the program, after this hour-long conversation, Pastor Eric Rotman joins us. We're going to be continuing a kind of an occasional series that we're doing with him as our author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for March, Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. We'll be doing Simon Peter and the Last Supper with Pastor Eric Rotman in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. today. Dr. Seleska, we have you back now.
You have us back.
The observation that I had made after I'd seen the film the first time was that Isaiah 53 seems to be as much a driving force of this film as the narratives of the gospel. It seems to provide the detail, whereas the gospel accounts may, at least in terms of the suffering, give us just the bare outlines. What do you think?
Yes, I think because it does begin with that Isaiah 53 passage. And there are a number of references in the beginning with that garden scene where Christ is making reference to some Old Testament passages, particularly in the Psalms. He says something like, save me and help me and I trust in you. There's another one, I am your servant and the son of your handmaid, I believe is another, which is from Psalm 116. I think that he has a number of references. We could also go to Psalm 22, which begins with, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And I believe that he was attempting at least to portray the Old Testament ideas in the sacrifices and then in Isaiah 53 and perhaps Psalm 22 as much as possible to indicate that that this had been predicted and that this is foreshadowed and that this is an event which was necessary. If you recall that passage from Luke 24, where Jesus is talking to the disciples on the road after his resurrection, O fools and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets had spoken, ought not Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory? Then beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded unto them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. Thus it is written, and thus it behooved Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead. So I think that he was at least to some degree faithful to some Old Testament texts, but in particular the Isaiah 53. I think you're correct on that. And whether or not he paid as much attention as he could have to all the gospel accounts, I hadn't thought through as I viewed the picture because, again, of that intense suffering that was promoted by the beatings.
There, again, to the opening scene, the Gethsemane scene, where Jesus is obviously distressed, and one thing that struck me by Gibson's depiction of Christ's trial in Gethsemane is that this is a Jesus who is having a hard time keeping his composure. He's trembling. He's obviously fearful. Is this an accurate portrayal of what the Gospels give us of Christ's trial in Gethsemane?
Yeah, well, he was truly human. You know the hymn verse that goes, Jesus, whelmed in fears unknown with our evil left alone, while no light from heaven shone. I think there the author was trying to portray that that same thing. And great drops of sweat like blood, so that there is this anticipation on his part of what he's going to have to endure. The movie, of course, does get across the physical suffering, but it does not get across, and obviously cannot get across, this suffering of the soul that he has to endure. What's going to happen to him is that the Father is going to lash out at him with the punishment which we deserve, the anger, the flaming wrath of God, his furious anger against sin would strike Christ. Then there would be that separation. Luther makes the statement that in the garden he still had a gracious God, but it's God against God on the cross. It's that God will punish him with the sin for the sins of all of humanity, and I don't think any of us can possibly understand what that means. But he knew he would have to endure this, and it would cause that kind of a trembling in the face of the separation from God. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? To have left everything else behind and then to be forsaken by God means that really you've lost everything. The tortures of soul that he suffered in this separation, the very tortures of the damned for us, I don't think anyone can fathom and no movie can portray. So we see the physical suffering, but the burden of sin, carrying it for all of humanity and then suffering the punishment for all of humanity, I think is involved in what you've mentioned there, this trembling. Look what he would have to endure.
Folks, we're here to take your questions and your comments on the film, The Passion of the Christ. Dr. John Seleska is our guest. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Mark is calling from his car. Mark, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Mark.
Old Testament, I thought the reference by Jesus' mother Mary, why is this night different than any other, bringing all the references to the Passover in, was pretty well done in the movie as well.
Thank you, Mark. Dr. Seleska, what about the references to the Passover? There's the flashbacks, and then, as Mark mentioned also, the scene where Mary and Mary Magdalene are woken out of sleep, and Mary asks, why is this night any different from others?
I didn't catch the last part. Why is this not any different?
Why is this night different from all other nights? Obviously, the beginning of the Seder liturgy for the Passover.
And, of course, he is going to be the Passover lamb. Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. So there again, you have that Old Testament allusion, and it's a very important one, fulfilled by Christ as our Passover lamb. Everything that happened to that Passover lamb would now occur in the life of in the death of our Lord himself as the true Passover lamb, fulfilling that Old Testament reference. So that is a good observation.
What about the accuracy in the film in its depiction of the Jewish leaders and of the hearing before the Sanhedrin, the chief priests and the leaders of the people?
Yeah, a lot has been said about that, and I anticipated wondering before I saw the film, whether or not it, in fact, would be anti-Semitic and that it would create some of the hostility toward the Jews that I guess some of the Jewish leaders today were afraid of. Now, I haven't heard of anything like that at all occurring, and I certainly didn't see any anti-Semitism in the film. I think it was an accurate portrayal of the chief priests, scribes, and Pharisees, and their determination to do away with this man who was very much of a threat to what they stood for, to everything, the power that was theirs, and the authority over the people, and the fact that he would be, quote, king, and that they no longer would control and rule. When that's threatened, it's evident that they're going to strike out and strike back at that, and you could see that. But actually, there are representatives at that event, and they represent really all of humanity and what humanity would do to God and what God would endure without without retaliation. So that I don't really see anything anti-Semitic in that at all. I would like also to address this idea that it is a historical fact that they encouraged the Romans to do what the Romans seemed delighted to do, that is, the soldiers themselves, not Pilate. So that I think that puts to rest any thought that there would be some other covenant by which the Jews would be saved so that we really shouldn't evangelize them. This is a Jewish Messiah. He himself is Jewish, and the disciples themselves are Jewish. The writers of the New Testament, except perhaps for Luke, were Jewish, so that the whole thing in the final analysis has that Jewish background, so that it shouldn't seem to anyone who knows the facts here to be anti-Semitic. But I thought it was a very good representation of how the scriptures portray these insistent leaders of the Jews and how they were determined to have him put to death and crucified. And it really does fulfill what was supposed to happen, this offering which God promised from eternity to make for sin and in time would do. And it must be, as Jesus said. So they represent all of humanity. So I didn't see that as really out of character at all for those people. I think any one of us under the same circumstances would do the same. When you're about to be dethroned, as they were, the human nature is, since the fall, to strike back, because I want to be king. I want to be Lord, and it's the temptation to which our first parents, Adam and Eve, succumbed. You can be God. And now we want to sit on the throne and pull the strings to make the people under us, the puppets, dance the way we intend for them to dance. And we use people and manipulate them and control them. It's the way we are. And these people illustrate it. They illustrate what all of us are like and how all of us would want to do to Christ if he were to intent on dethroning us, would want to do to him.
Bill is calling from his car. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I don't know if anybody could answer this question or if we should even try to speculate on it, but the suffering that Christ endured, the spiritual suffering, that is, as your guest said, the torments of hell, has anybody postulated when that would have started? What, did it take place in a split second? Did it last a full 6 hours? Or are there any thoughts on that?
That's a very interesting question, Bill, and I'm glad you raised it. It's been raised by people who've written the program here, who've written me, Dr. Seleska, saying, look, are we to understand Christ's suffering for sin only in terms of the 12 hours beginning at Gethsemane, or only in terms of the beating, or only in terms of the hours upon the cross? Can we answer the question?
Well, obviously the incarnation, beginning with his conception by the Holy Spirit, is for a sinful, fallen humanity. That is his sinless conception for my sinful conception, and that's true all the way along the line. It's Christ as the substitute for all of humanity, that he might suffer death for all mankind, the writer of the Hebrews says. So I take it that everything that occurred during his humiliation in one way or another was as a substitute for humanity. He did for us what we could not do for ourselves, fulfill the law for us, keeping those Old Testament laws perfectly, loving God above all things and loving neighbor as self, though that summarizes the entire law. And when we couldn't do it, he did it. And, of course, that is now applied to us or ascribed to us by faith so that it's really ours. So it, in a certain sense, then that the great suffering occurs now as he begins the Passion. in the garden, and then finally on the cross, and then that complete separation, the tortures of hell, as I mentioned, that the God would inflict the lightning of his wrath on his son, which is what we deserved, occurs at that point then in the Passion.
Bernice is calling from St. Charles. We'll have time to take her call and perhaps a very brief beginning of a response. Bernice, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, I loved the movie. I questioned the scourging, whipping scene, that the two Marys could have viewed it, that any women could have been present for that. Do you think that's possible, that this was open to the public? I thought it was done in the soldiers' quarters.
Thank you very much, Bernice. That's an excellent question as well. Dr. Seleska, you've got about a minute here before we need to take our first break.
Well, my feeling is, of course, that the Mary was there and the others were watching, and that would that not be, as you consider what a mother has to endure for children in the first place by giving birth, and then the love that a mother shows for her child. But now, could you imagine what this must have meant for Mary to endure what I'm convinced she saw? And there, obviously, she was present, because you recall the words of Jesus to her, "Mother, behold your son," and to John, "Behold your mother." So it's very clear that she did see this.
And it would have been would not have been typical for the Romans to, especially because Pilate's trying to appease the wrath of the crowd, to have privately punished him.
Yeah, Jesus said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, don't weep for me, weep for yourselves," you recall, so that they must have been viewing this all along the way.
We're getting a brief review of Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ. Dr. John Seleska has joined us to lend his expertise to us and to our listeners in this hour. When we come back, 25 minutes left in this conversation. Your questions and your comments on The Passion of the Christ are certainly welcome at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Seleska is a former professor at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He currently serves as the director of the Concordia Bible Institute based in Mequon, Wisconsin. When we come back, we're talking about the accuracies, and we'll continue to press on through Peter's denial, Judas's torment. That's one that was perhaps a little more license was taken there. We've talked a bit about the scourging. What about the crucifixion account and the relatively short shrift, but I think a strong emphasis upon the resurrection of Christ. In the end, we've got to answer this question. No matter who makes the film, no matter how it's made, no matter how brutally it's portrayed, can any film ever really capture accurately those 12 hours, the 12 hours that have made all the difference in the history of the human race, redeeming a fallen and condemned race of mankind to God through the sinless sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the Son of God in human flesh? Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our review of Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ with Dr. John Seleska continues right after this. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.